running who openly say on television and everywhere else that they are supported and backed by Iran are on the scene. They are amongst the so-called protesters now, just outside the embassy. They are overseeing the attack on the U.S. embassy. People like Qaisal Ghazali, the head of Asaib Ahl al-Haq, AAH group, people like Faleh al-Fayyad, the national security advisor, who is known for his ties to Iran. These people are all at the scene, and they are amongst the protesters.
I want to underline another thing here. The video that we've seen suggests hundreds of people, perhaps, outside the United States Embassy, but perhaps not thousands of people. It is not an enormous protest. And we should notice there have been enormous protests in Baghdad in recent months, protests that in some measure are protests against the influence of Iran. How does this seeming pro-Iranian protest compare in size to what has been seen on the streets of Baghdad in recent months?
Well, it is minute in terms of numbers and size. I just spoke to people in Tahrir Square who are saying they are much more peaceful now because all the people who were attacking them, who were killing them over the past 2 months, are now outside the U.S. embassy, and they are not connected at all with the, they are on the other side of the river, across the U.S. embassy, further up a little bit, but. They come out in, sometimes they are near a million, some of their protests, but these people are in their hundreds. It is very clear. It is exactly the same number of people that these people that once a month ago, they tried to come up with a parallel protest, but because of the numbers, they could not take the protest to Tahrir Square. This time they used this opportunity to attack the U.S. embassy and there's some pressure on them.
Journalist Hiwa Osman in Erbil, Iraq, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And let's bring another voice in now. Farhad Aladdin is head of the Iraqi Advisory Council, which is a think tank that does a lot of work in Baghdad. We have found him in London. Welcome to the program, sir.
Oh, thank you.
What do you make of what you've just heard about who is protesting, how many, and who seems to be behind it?
Well, it's clear this is the U.S.-Iran conflict playing out in Iraq, and Iraq is becoming an arena for that conflict. And it is unfortunate that the Iraqis always wanted and the Iraqi policymakers wanted to be neutral to this conflict as much as possible. But the recent events prevents that being neutrality, and the Iraqis would be paying a heavy price for it.
You say the Iraqis will be paying a heavy price for it. That is an interesting note. The President of the United States is now commenting on this. He's been on Twitter, saying on Twitter that Iran, quote, will be held fully responsible, blaming Iran fully for this, not blaming the individual Iraqis who may be the people outside the embassy. But you say this could be damaging to Iraq as well. Why?
Well, obviously, it's Iraq is the arena, and the people who get killed are Iraqis, regardless of affiliation. And in addition, that any attack on the diplomatic missions, foreigners, the American or otherwise, would be held responsible, and Iraq would be suffering the consequences. And Iraq, in its fragile state, its economy's fragility, the security, and everything else, is going to be very difficult to sustain. Or stand any sort of punishment, really, that could face as a consequence of this conflict. And Iraq should have nothing to do with it. But it is becoming increasingly involved in this tug of war.
Should we think of this militia as purely an arm of Iran? I can imagine an armed group in Iraq saying, we're Iraqis, we're patriotic, we just accept some Iranian support. Should we instead just think of them as virtually an Iranian group?
There are groups which are loyal to Iran, and they believe that what they're doing is a borderless cause that they have, and that's why they crossed Syria and Lebanon and other places. And these people do work closely with the Iranian mission, if you want, in terms of their fight and what they call the resistance.
Farhad Aladdin, analyst with the Iraqi Advisory Council, thank you so much for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's what's up next. The man accused of attacking people in a rabbi's home in Muncie, New York over the weekend is now facing federal hate crime charges. The FBI said the man, Grafton Thomas, seems to have been driven by anti-Semitism, and they are citing his journal entries and his internet search history. Gwen Hogan of member station WNYC is with us now. She's been following this story. Gwen, good morning.
Good morning.
So authorities got hold of this man's personal effects. What was Grafton Thomas searching for online?
That's right. Federal prosecutors say that in his search history on his phone, they found he'd conducted searches like "Why did Hitler hate the Jews?", "German Jewish temples near me?", "Prominent companies founded by Jews in America." They also found journals with his writings in them, and they found anti-Semitic phrases in them, as well as swastikas.
All right, so certainly a lot there that would appear to be incriminating. Now, here's a different take on this. Yesterday, a woman named Wendy Page talked to reporters. She is Grafton's mom's pastor. Let's listen to what she said.
Kim never expressed to me at any point as her pastor for the last more than 10 years that she was afraid of or scared of her son in any way. I've been at visits in the hospital. I've been at visits with him at the house. He's always been a gentle giant with mental illness.
Now, that is also his family's view of this man. He has a mental illness, but he is not an anti-Semite. What else do we know about him for certain?
Right. We know he was raised in Queens by a single mom. His mother immigrated from Guyana. He was in the Marines briefly after high school, but left following an injury. For the last decade or so, he suffered from severe mental illness. He was in and out of the hospital, was on disability for it. His attorney, Michael Sussman, is asking for a psychiatric evaluation of his client.
Okay. Let me ask you about how people in Muncie and in other Jewish communities in the area are reacting to this.
You know, I was up there yesterday, and many of the people that I talked to said they were scared. You know, this is just the latest violent attack on an Orthodox Jewish community. You may remember not a month ago in Jersey City, there was a mass shooting at a kosher supermarket. So it's sort of these series of incidents that have people feeling on edge, feeling like they're a target. This is a community that wears, you know, traditional dress, and so they're more visibly Jewish than other groups. And they've said that they've seen this kind of increase in hate speech that first started online, and then they saw it in real life with drawings of swastikas in physical locations, and now there are physical attacks.
Gwen Hogan of member station WNYC. Thanks, Gwen.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to us on your local member station. You can keep the conversation going with us on social media. I'm Noelle King. You can reach me on Twitter at Noelle King. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR. David Green is at NPR Green. And Steve Inskeep is at NPR Inskeep. To find out more about the people who put this show together every day, go to our website, npr.org/morningedition, and click on the staff tabs to read about our amazing crew of editors and producers. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Hannah Haynes. Coming up in just a bit on the program, shuttered industrial sites are drawing new tenants, data centers, which are attracted to the ability to access bountiful and cheap electricity. But their economic impact is mixed. We'll visit a former industrial plant in upstate New York that's found a new life as a high-tech computer data center. That's in about 15 minutes here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Celebrate the season with special programs on Wisconsin Public Radio all this month. Enjoy festive music from Simply Folk, Christmas music from the Morehouse and Spelman Glee Clubs, and the annual New Year's Concert from Vienna. Find a complete schedule of holiday programs at wpr.org/holidays.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, providing professional construction services to customers in a variety of markets nationwide for more than 125 years. More about markets served, featured projects, and news is at bolt.com.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
Taking a look at the weather forecast, no more snow is expected today. Strong winds up to 40 miles per hour in some areas, highs in the low 30s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, no snow expected again, highs in the upper 30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Noom, a personalized program based in psychology to help people understand their motivations, change their habits, and lead healthier lives. Learn more at Noom, NOOM.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities in education and entrepreneurship to create uncommon solutions and empower people to shape their lives and be more successful. More online at Kauffman.org. From Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting Just Mercy, based on the true story of a modern hero, starring Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx, and Brie Larson, now playing in select theaters everywhere January 10th. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In Haiti, opponents of the president say they'll be back on the streets on New Year's Day. Protesters took a break for the holidays after months of street demonstrations. Now they plan to return until their president leaves. NPR's Carrie Khan reports.
At a Port-au-Prince gas station, Marcus Saint-Pierre fills up his moto taxi. These small motorcycles are the best at getting through the capital's hellish traffic. I use this old thing to make a living, to give my kids food and to pay for their school, he says. But lately, after protesters took to the streets to demand President Jovenel Moïse resign, he hasn't been able to work. His kids haven't gone to school and food prices have skyrocketed. I just want some stability in the country, he says. Haiti has long used to political and economic crises, but observers say the latest clashes between the president and his opponents have brought suffering and dysfunction to new depths. Riots began last July after the government announced plans to hike gas prices. It didn't follow through, but the protests have continued, with the last few months being some of the most violent. At least 55 people have died and more than 100 injured, according to the UN.
We spent like a month without getting gas. And when we receive, it's very little, you know.
Hans de Touche manages this gas station in Pétionville in the hills above the city. This one and another station closer to downtown have been repeatedly attacked during the demonstrations.
You know, we just have to repent because they had a car over there, you know, and they put fire on it.
Right here?
Right here.
The burned-out car has been removed and the wall freshly painted during a break in the protest that lasted much of December. But demonstrators say they will be back New Year's Day, Haiti's Independence Day. They're demanding investigations into the waste of billions of dollars of earthquake relief funds, and they want the president investigated for allegedly misappropriating aid from the Venezuela oil program known as Petrocaribe. President Moïse denies any wrongdoing. Opposition leader Michel André says the president has lost all credibility. This corruption has made it impossible for the state to meet even the most basic needs of the people, says André. The protests and roadblocks have crippled food distribution, especially outside the capital. Nearly 4 million Haitians are unable to reliably get food.
Et je demande aux Américains.
The Americans and the international community must stop supporting a president who can no longer run this country, says Andre. Moïse took office in 2017 after an election with only 21% turnout. His popularity has plummeted ever since. The U.S., though, remains committed to engaging with Moïse as its democratically elected president. The State Department tells NPR the U.S. will support a Haitian-led solution to end the gridlock. Earlier this month, the Vatican and the United Nations tried to bring both sides to the negotiating table. President Moïse invited opponents to the National Palace before Christmas. All declined. As the political stalemate continues, human rights activist Marie-Jolene Gilles says criminals and gangs are taking advantage of the power vacuum. There is terrible sadness in Haiti now. She says more than 100 gangs are operating on the island. Gilles, now 58, says she believes she will not see a fair and just Haiti in her lifetime. But 29-year-old Emmanuela Duong is part of a new phenomenon taking place in Haiti now that has young artists and professionals demanding clean government. She says she's not giving up.
If I have to leave Haiti because I can't live here anymore, I have to at least try. And I have to give everything before giving up.
Dion says she will be back out on the streets in the new year. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
West Virginia Governor Jim Justice says he approved firing a class of more than 30 prison guard trainees. A photo appeared to show them all giving a Nazi salute in class. And what may be most remarkable is the kind of class in which they gave it. Here's Emily Allen of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
The picture shows the cadets dressed in their uniforms, sitting and standing for a class photo. Their arms are outstretched in a Nazi-like salute. A state investigation found the picture was taken at the direction of a class instructor who was in charge of teaching cultural diversity. Jeff Sandy is secretary of the West Virginia Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety. He says there's evidence the cadets were greeting the instructor this way 2 weeks into the training.
If she would have said, "That is inappropriate behavior, do not do that again," we would not be here today.
The photo was copied, and there were plans to distribute it with graduation packets, despite complaints from at least three staffers to their supervisor.
All the cadets in the photo have been terminated. In addition to that, there is three instructors who have been terminated, and there are four instructors that are looking at suspensions without pay.
The corrections employees still can appeal their terminations. A few blocks from the West Virginia State Capitol is the B'nai Jacob Synagogue. Rabbi Victor Yurecki was one of the faith leaders briefed about the photo before it was made public. Yurecki says the officer's gesture was offensive, but he doesn't think it was deliberately discriminatory.
It was both a confirmation that this was not something directed at Jews. It wasn't something necessarily of hate, but of profound ignorance. And that is both comforting and depressing at the same time.
State officials say they will continue working with religious leaders, the Anti-Defamation League, and other outside groups. They want them to come in to future training classes to teach their cadets about cultural tolerance and historical injustice. For NPR News, I'm Emily Allen in Charleston, West Virginia.
This is NPR News.
A big change is coming to New York's criminal justice system. In 2020, the state will severely restrict the use of cash bail.
You had a problem of individuals who were incarcerated pre-trial because they were poor. And that problem, quite frankly, affected more people of color as well.
The benefits and challenges of limiting cash bail. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on WPR. Coming up in the newscast, some fire departments in Wisconsin are switching to firefighting foam free of PFAS chemicals. The chemicals pose dangers to human health, and we'll get more details on the story following this news update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad today. Tear gas and stun grenades were used to push back protesters who forced their way into the embassy compound. They denounced the U.S. and President Trump for deadly airstrikes in Iraq targeting members of an Iranian-backed militia. They killed at least 25 fighters. Trump accuses Iran of orchestrating the embassy breach. There are no reports of embassy personnel being injured. Kim Jong-un has been addressing North Korean leadership this week, with analysts saying Kim has offered no clear signal that his country is shifting to a more hardline policy. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Seoul.
State media report that Kim Jong-un called for diplomatic and military countermeasures to protect the country's sovereignty and security. Kim has used similar language over the past 3 days while addressing a plenum of the ruling Workers' Party Central Committee. Analysts note that such long meetings are rare in North Korean history and are meant to signal that the leadership is making big decisions in difficult circumstances. They also speculate that Pyongyang may be ramping up pressure on the U.S. while leaving the door open to last-minute concessions ahead of a year-end deadline. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Kim will deliver his annual New Year's address tomorrow. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Hannah Haynes. The invasive lily leaf beetle is poised to become a major headache for Wisconsin's commercial flower growers and hobby gardeners. Will Cushman reports.
The lily leaf beetle eats just that, lily leaves. The bright red beetle devours both native and cultivated varieties. The beetle was first sighted in central Wisconsin in 2014 and appeared this year in Madison and Ellison Bay. University of Wisconsin-Madison entomologist P.J. Leash explained on WPR's The Larry Mueller Show that lily leaf beetles can be so destructive that some growers have given up on the flowers altogether.
I have been to meetings with commercial flower growers and had conversations with folks growing flowers basically in central Wisconsin near Wausau, and they've, you know, stopped growing lilies.
The beetle is only a problem for true lilies. It does not feed on day lilies, canna, or calla lilies. Will Cushman, Wisconsin Public Radio.
To learn more about this story, visit our partners at wiscontext.org. The Madison Fire Department no longer fights fires with foam that contains PFAS chemicals. PFAS are linked to health problems in humans, and they can be found in firefighting foam, nonstick cooking pans, and other everyday products. Madison Fire Chief Stephen Davis says the department started thinking about the switch after a transformer fire in July when PFAS were found in stormwater runoff.
Kind of from a selfish standpoint, as chief, I don't feel safe with our firefighters being exposed to those products.
Fond du Lac's fire department also stopped using foam with PFAS. The Tavern League of Wisconsin will offer free rides home to people throughout the state tonight for New Year's Eve. The Safe Ride program will be available in nearly every county. The La Crosse Tribune reports the La Crosse County Tavern League and its Safe Ride program has recently partnered with the rideshare service Lyft to help link bar patrons with safe rides home, rides home, and the program will also serve rural areas. According to the Tavern League, last year, Tavern League members provided more than 91,000 rides. The program is funded partially by the surcharge on OWI convictions, and the rest is paid by Tavern League members. The program runs all year round. You're listening to news from WPR. You can find more news online. Go to WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to develop data-driven, nonpartisan solutions for complex issues. More information is available at pewtrusts.org. From the Wallace Foundation, fostering improvements in learning and enrichment for disadvantaged children, and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas at wallacefoundation.org. And from the ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Nissan's former chairman, Carlos Ghosn, has fled Japan. He was facing trial for allegations of financial misconduct. Ghosn was once one of the most powerful figures in the auto industry until his arrest in 2018. He'd been released on bail in Tokyo earlier this year, placed under close surveillance, and ordered to surrender his passports, precautions that apparently were not enough. Simon Denyer is the Washington Post bureau chief in Tokyo. He's on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Steve.
How did Carlos Ghosn get to Lebanon?
Well, I wish I knew. It's a mystery that woke us all up this morning, I have to say. You know, we thought at first, or a lot of people thought at first, there had to be, the authorities had to know that the Japanese had brokered some deal with the Lebanese government. The Japanese vice foreign minister was in Lebanon recently. But, you know, as the day's gone on and the Japanese government sounds mystified as the rest of us, we're beginning to think that some kind of daring escape kind of took place where Ghosn just outfoxed everybody and left.
How does he explain his departure?
He just says he hasn't explained it yet. He's promised to talk to the media from Beirut in coming days. He's basically just said he's not a fugitive from justice. He's a fugitive from injustice. So he's fleeing an unfair court system. He's been complaining. He and his lawyers have been complaining that this was a stitch-up from the very start. They've been extremely frustrated at his treatment. They don't think he's going to get a fair trial. And it seems as though he finally decided that the prospect of 15 years, up to 15 years in jail, which is the maximum sentence, against losing his bail money, which was a record $14 million, you know, it was a better bet to leave and let the money go.
I guess we don't want to speculate too much here, but I'm just thinking about the available facts. He was still a very wealthy man, correct? And if what you needed to get out of Japan was a fake passport or encouraging some official to look the other way, money might be the thing that would make that happen for you.
Well, that's possible. I mean, we do have unnamed Lebanese security official told Japan's state broadcaster that a person resembling Carlos Ghosn arrived in a private jet traveling under a different name with a different passport. So, you know, that has to be a possibility that somehow forged documents were used, some airfield was used, and a private jet got him out of the country. But as I say, we really don't know the details. Hopefully we will in the next few days.
What is it that Carlos Ghosn allegedly did that he says are unfair charges? What does the government say he did?
It rather complicated sort of financial misdemeanors, underreporting his income, doing deals with car dealerships in the Middle East that with Nissan money that personally benefited him, transferring some money from a Nissan account to one of his accounts during the financial crisis to cover losses, money he said he was with Nissan's knowledge and he paid back.
Can he be tried in absentia without being there?
I don't know, actually. It's possible, but certainly there's very little chance of it being extradited. There's no extradition treaty between Lebanon and Japan. He's a very popular figure in the Lebanon, so I think he has escaped justice for the time being.
Simon Denyer of The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks very much, Steve.
He's on Skype.
Closed factories and fossil fuel plants are being reborn as data centers. They hold computers for high-tech digital companies. Kate Kay went to a former aluminum plant in Messina, New York, where a new data center is bringing new hope, but also some new worries.
Little kids skated gingerly on the ice in the Messina Arena, where Karen and Ronald Aldis waited for their grandson's hockey game to start. For decades, thousands of children here might have looked ahead to a job at one of the northern New York town's auto or aluminum plants. Now, most of them have shut down. Karen lamented the toll job loss has taken on the area. She's felt it in the hockey community here.
We've lost some great families that really supported the program. They've had to move on.
But those factories relied on something still going strong, the hydropower dam right here on the St. Lawrence River. Today, energy infrastructure that provided power in the past, sometimes right on site, appeals to an emerging industry, electricity-hungry data centers. Sites where industrial dinosaurs were left for dead, a Pennsylvania steel plant, a North Carolina textile mill, an Alabama coal-fired power plant have been reanimated as homes for computers used for digital data operations. CoinMint runs a data center inside a former aluminum plant here in Messina that was built to accommodate the extreme heat generated from smelting. These noisy computers inside it now get pretty hot too, says CoinMint Chief Operating Officer Norbert Guillaume.
This is another reason why this site is so attractive, because it's so far north. And it has this scenario with this, I'm not going to call it natural air conditioning, but air conditioning built in.
Computers in this open-air building live inside shipping containers that keep out dirt. On a busy Friday night at Morley's American Grill in Messina, Joseph Lacombe described his job inspecting those computers. One of 80 workers in the data center, he recently got a promotion and relocated to Messina to be closer to his full-time job. Both Lacombe's grandfathers worked in the aluminum plant where he now makes a living.
It's kind of crazy, you know, like walking through, being like they walked this back in the day when it was the aluminum plant, and to see what it is now.
Dave LeClaire Jr. was there the day they pulled the plug on the aluminum plant. He works with the United Steelworkers Union local.
Hi. Oh, I'm Dave.
LeClaire said some in Messina worry heavy hydroelectricity use by the data center could deter other companies with big energy needs, ones that would hire more workers, from considering their town.
There are people out there that think that they're taking this natural resource and going to end up spoiling it for other opportunities.
CoinMint did not receive government incentives to renovate in Messina, but elsewhere, governments have lured firms, including Google and Facebook, with millions of dollars in subsidies, hoping to preserve property tax revenue and create data center jobs, despite the fact these operations often do not require many workers. In town at the Messina Arena, both hope and doubt are palpable. People like Ronald Aldis fear a future without the sort of full-time, labor-intensive job opportunities that were here in the past.
We need something into the area that pay more than minimum wage, because some of these people working minimum wage are working two or three jobs with no benefits. We worry about our grandchildren.
Ultimately, people wonder whether any industry will create the sorts of jobs needed to support youth hockey players and other kids here when they're grown. For NPR News, I'm Kate Kay in Messina, New York.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:42 right now, and there's much more Morning Edition still, to come today. Music communities around the globe lost dozens of shining voices this year. And ahead, NPR Music celebrates some of the musicians who left the world in 2019. Stick around for that, coming up.
I'm Lori Skelton, and I'll be hosting an Earthbound Expeditions trip to Croatia and Slovenia May 26th through June 7th. The trip includes 7 nights cruising on board a yacht along the Dalmatian coast. Every breakfast is included, as well as 12 multi-course meals and a number of shore excursions, plus 2 nights in each capital city. Capacity is limited by the number of cabins on the yacht. More details are available at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar, full-service solar installers dedicated to making it easy and economical to achieve energy independence. Details on home and business solar options are at allenergysolar.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, that's what keeps you coming back. Visit jackandrea.com for more information.
In the weather forecast, it'll be windy today, up to 40 miles per hour, winds in some areas of the state, highs in the low 30s. Tomorrow, it'll be mostly sunny, no snow is expected, with highs in the upper 30s. And then on Thursday, a bit warmer, highs in the mid-40s in the south and the upper 30s in the north. Snow likely in northern Wisconsin late Thursday night into Friday. The National Weather Service is warning drivers of slick and snow-covered roads today. There may be accidents and road closures. You can get more information about road conditions by calling 511 or going to 511wi.gov. Classical music is just about 15 minutes away following Morning Edition. Stick around for that.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Metamucil Premium Blend contains plant-based psyllium fiber, is made with natural flavors and colors, and is sweetened with stevia leaf extract. Learn more at Metamucil.com. And from iDrive, providing cloud backup, full system backup, and on-site iDrive appliance to protect PCs, Macs, and servers from data loss due to crashes and ransomware. At iDrive.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Two stories from 2019 that were illustrative about the United States economy. A trade war with China and a strike at General Motors where tens of thousands of workers walked a picket line. Other business stories came and went quickly, but some of them are worth remembering. NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley rounded a few up. Hey, Scott.
Good morning.
So where do we start here?
We start on a hot summer day in Mississippi. That's where immigration officials raided more than half a dozen chicken processing plants last summer in what was described as one of the nation's largest worksite enforcement actions. Almost 700 people who were employed by companies there were arrested on suspicion of working in the country illegally. Mike Hurst is the local U.S. attorney.
While we are a nation of immigrants, more than that, we are first and foremost a nation of laws.
And Noel, those raids are emblematic of the Trump administration's get tough policy towards illegal immigration. We've talked a lot about stepped up enforcement along the border with Mexico, but since 2017, there's also been a significant increase in worksite investigations, and the Mississippi raids are one high profile example.
There was also a big business story this year, Scott, that involved beef, or at least a substitute beef. Tell us about that.
Yeah, beef substitutes were another big story. Plant-based foods that mimic beef were everywhere in 2019, including your local fast food joint.
100% Whopper and 0% beef. We know it's impossible to believe. The Impossible Whopper.
Companies like Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat have been making a big splash with consumers who like the taste of meat but worry about the environmental costs or animal welfare. Beyond Meat had a sizzling debut in the stock market, although its shares have since fallen back to earth. Big players like Kellogg's introduced their own product. Kellogg's is called Incogmeato. And the traditional beef industry is taking this threat very seriously. They're pushing back hard against what they call fake meat.
Sizzling debut. I like that. Let me ask you about another stock sale. It made news because it didn't actually happen. This is the co-working company WeWork.
That's right. WeWork's charismatic founder, Adam Neumann, spun the story of shared office space as more than just office, but shared community. He generated a lot of buzz, made a lot of money for himself. What he didn't generate was profits. Lise Beyer of the advisory firm Class 5 Group says when investors took a closer look at Neumann's company this fall, they got cold feet.
It took magic. It took a leap of faith greater than the Grand Canyon to see how that business could be profitable anytime soon.
Neumann was ousted as CEO. The stock sale was canceled. And even in this time of stock market exuberance, Noel, rational investors figured out WeWork was basically an office company that only thought it should be priced like a tech company.
Tech companies, though, also had their own problems this year, right?
Oh, they did. Silicon Valley has a big target on its back and is taking arrows from all sides. You know, Republicans have complained for years about left-leaning bias in the tech sector. Now you have Democrats like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez grilling Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg over his company's policy on political ads.
Do you see a potential problem here with a complete lack of fact-checking on political advertisements?
Well, Congresswoman, I think lying is bad. And I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad.
But Zuckerberg insists it's not his company's job to police that. You've also got state attorneys general investigating both Facebook and Google for possible antitrust violations. Apple and Amazon are under scrutiny as well. You know, there's just growing concern over how these big tech companies are affecting competition, privacy, the information we all get on our phones, and look for that scrutiny to continue as we move into an election year in 2020.
Next, 2020, tomorrow, NPR Scott Horsley. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Hannah Haynes, and this is Morning Edition. In the weather forecast, strong winds across the state today, highs in the low 30s, mostly sunny for the first day of 2020 tomorrow, no snow expected, and highs in the upper 30s. And then on Thursday, a bit warmer during the day, highs in the mid 40s in the south and upper 30s in the north, and then snow is likely in northern Wisconsin late Thursday night into Friday morning.
Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, an eco-friendly producer of handmade truffles and caramels, where 10% of sales are donated to organizations helping disadvantaged women and children. Shop locally or online. SweetImpactChocolates.com.
In intimate concert setting, WPR is pleased to support classical music in our communities. For more information, go to WPR.org/events.
In sports, the Bucks beat the Bulls last night. Score was 123-102. Their next game is tomorrow at 7 when they'll face the Timberwolves. And the Badgers football team will play in the Rose Bowl tomorrow. Game time is 4 o'clock.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Every year around this time, we take a few minutes to remember some of the musicians we lost with a montage of their work. In 2019, that included opera star Jesse Norman, Rick Ocasek of The Cars, jazz saxophonist Joseph Jarman, and the bluegrass singer Mack Wiseman.
Very, very special night.
I feel the room swaying, for the band's playing one of my old favorite songs from way back when.
Good night, sweetheart, good night.
Daydreaming, just
life, and just how long will it last? Will you be happy and satisfied when you pass? Will you die young or old and wise? If you face your killer, will there be tears in your eyes?
And I'll tell a story about an artist growing old.
I remember when
answers seemed so clear. We had never lived without or tasted fear.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
I told myself back then that I would do this, and I always looked so out of reach and just seemed so confusing that I found my place in life, a young black man that seemed so useless.
Como el viento que pasa volando por la falda de la gran montaña, así llegan a mí los recuerdos.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. Time is marching on, pretty soon I'll be gone.
Yes, you. Are you doing what you wanna do?
Lazy bones, sleeping in the sun. How'd you expect to get your day's work done?
Vai minha tristeza e diz a ela que sem ela não pode ser.
Come hear Uncle John's band playing to the tide. Come with me or go alone. He's come to take his children home.
That was poet and Grateful Dead songwriter Robert Hunter. This montage was produced by Tom Cole with help from reference librarians Jane Gilvin and Will Chase. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Hannah Haynes. Good morning. You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. And join us this afternoon for BBC NewsHour beginning at 3, followed by All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30. It's a minute before 9 o'clock, and stay with us. The latest news from NPR is just ahead.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, featuring indoor water parks and theme parks, dining, and outdoor recreation. Information about entertainment and more is at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.
There are moments in life where we all must rise, where we all must answer the call. Join me, Austin Brandt.
And me, Tim Williamson.
On a new podcast from WGTD and Gateway.
Where we highlight the tremendous sacrifices of emergency medical personnel. Subscribe to The Call, now on Apple and Google Podcasts.
You're listening to WGTD HD.